Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Sara Gon. Sara, welcome back from KZN. I believe you were traveling around the country's many magnificent battlefields.
The old battlefields.
Yes, and they are truly
worth visiting. You're not talking Green Street.
No, I'm not talking Green Street. I'm talking the hinterland, which is fascinating.
Yeah. No, that's where I come from, actually.
I know. We must discuss.
And of course, we're also joined once again today by Mr. Terence Corrigan, who had some thoughts specifically on foreign policy that he wanted to talk about. So, Terence, welcome back.
It's very good. Very good to be here. Two days in a row, and just as cold today as it was yesterday.
Yes.
Indeed, it is a grey and miserable day in Johannesburg, but nonetheless. That never stops the flame of liberty burning. So let's start off with our first story, and this is that the Department of International Relations and Cooperation has reacted with fury to comments recently made by a spokesperson for Eswatini, formerly known as Swaziland. The department has said that it will summon Eswatini's ambassador to South Africa to seek an explanation for utterances made by one of its spokespeople about South Africa. So, this is a little bit of a tangled web, but EFF Secretary General Godrick Gardie, there was a very publicly known story of the horrible murder of his daughter, Hilary Gardie, and apparently on Twitter, Godrick claimed that the monarchy of Eswatini had a role in the murder of his daughter. So in response to these allegations, Eswatini denied them very strongly, and they sent a spokesperson onto SAFM to basically rebut these allegations. And the spokesperson said a number of things, but one of the things he said was he described South Africa as being infested with a cancer of criminality from head to toe. And it is in fact these sentiments that have outraged the Department of International Relations and gotten the Eswatini ambassador summoned. So this is a little bit of a spat. There's definitely always been some people inside the ANC who have not really, shall we say, liked Eswatini that much. Sara, what do you make of this story? It's very bizarre. Firstly, the sort of the allegation that the Eswatini government is involved in an EFF politician's family murder, and then also the subsequent claim by the spokesperson that we are infested with criminality.
Well, let's start with the latter. I don't see what the problem is with that. I think 58 million South Africans probably think the same thing, and so it would be nothing new, nothing different.
The more than 60 people who are murdered a day, probably.
Yes, exactly. They're at least their families. I think it's probably a long-standing this little bit of animosity. But you should also be careful that you must bear in mind that Godrick Gardie made this allegation, extraordinary as it is, on Twitter. And, that is not exactly CNN or even SABC. And so it's a sort of snit that I think the department got itself, it got its nose into a bit of a snit over this one, because it's really a comment that it's a spat between Gardie making this extraordinary allegation, which may or may not be true, and the spokesperson, responding somewhat angrily, defending his king. I don't know. A chat on the telephone or a cup of tea would have, I think, done it. I think this is sort of the Department of International Affairs trying to beat his chest and show how irate it was that it called in, that it had to call in the spokesperson. Certainly, I mean, it's an extraordinary allegation to make, and, I'm sure it's easily perceived as an insult to the king, but the response, while it may be a little hot-headed, is not exactly news to anybody. So I think for them to have paid so much attention to it is actually complete and utter nonsense.
Right. It's, as I presume he was saying this, I didn't hear the interview myself, but I presume he was saying this in defense of the Swazi king, saying basically, well, how can you say that this is our fault when South Africa has murders all the time. And that's, you know, that's a pretty reasonable point, especially when the allegation, as far as I understand, is, shall we say, not fleshed out.
Well, let's put it this way. Sorry, can I, if I can just put it, say, you know, to call in the Swazi ambassador over this and not perhaps call in, for example, I mean, we know why it's not, but say the Russian ambassador over the invasion of Ukraine, you know, there's a little bit of disproportion here, shall we say.
Yes, we tend to not really call in ambassadors for anything, unless apparently it's saying something that's true. Terence, what do you make of all this? You've recently written an article that will be published relatively soon on South Africa's foreign policy and how government views it.
Well, here's an interesting idea. I think it was 2019, a memo from a number of Western embassies. I think it was Britain, Germany, United States, Switzerland, and the Netherlands. Yes. Was, you know, I think cumulatively there was like 70% of our foreign investment stock sent a note to the South African government about issues to do with the investment climate. From everything I could understand, this was sort of meant in a good spirit and an invitation to comment. And I remember the ANC just losing its stuff.
I remember over
this, and this was neo-colonialism or whatever. I don't know. I can't help thinking that there's maybe something of a symmetry here. Why does the ruling party of South Africa get to damn some of our biggest trading investment partners as neo-colonialists? Where and we get so upset about one of our neighbors saying that we are racked with a cancer of criminality. Now, why this is particularly interesting for me is that about a week ago, South Africa, or actually not even a week ago, beginning of this week, the Department of International Relations and Cooperation released a document where they try to define South Africa's national interest. Now, it's interesting that we've been like operating apparently without a proper national interest for close to three decades, but you know, weird things happen in this country.
Better late than never, right?
Yeah, better late than never. Look, it's not particularly groundbreaking, and in fact, this is not the first attempt. And for those of us with long memories, as I always like to start stuff I say here with, I'm old enough to remember. There are bits and pieces that come very much from the 2011 white paper. But apparently this was several years in the making, and I don't know what takes several years to do 36 pages. When I was a university student, that was like a tough Sunday night when you realized it had to be on a Monday. But apparently we can take several years to define our national interest. And what I found particularly interesting here, I mean, there's nothing exceptional. There's the thing about how, you know, we in favor of liberation struggles and, you know, we need to improve people's standards of living. There's a sort of idealism and pragmatism at least set out. But there seems to be no understanding or recognition, well, no recognition of problems that were identified, for instance, by the National Development Plan that said, you know, we have this massive suite of embassies around the world. In fact, one of the biggest diplomatic footprints in the world. We have ambassadors who are earning on a par with those from developed countries. And what do we get from this? This is the National Planning Commission, the National Development Plan, which is identified in the National Interest Document as the guiding light of our national interest. And it seems to me that basically, you know, thinking about this, South Africa is unable to assert any of the facets of its national interest, any of the material ones. You know, people's well-being, human development, economic growth, whatever, trade. In fact, we seem to be going back on that because we're all about localization now. The African agenda, although the Zimbabweans are being shipped back to the tender mercies of the ZANU-PF regime, might, you know, like have questions, or for that matter, the Swazis who are find themselves now being the subject of a summoning. But there's sort of no, But And the only thing that, that South Africa really seems able to do is the ideological stuff. Now, initially this was in the 1990s, this was put as, you know, a democracy, human rights or whatever. But I think, you know, that went out the window very, very quickly. And I do not judge the government too harshly for that, because it's always a difficult thing to do. And for instance, over the Ken Sarawiwa affair, South Africa burnt its fingers when it, you know, it, when Mandela tried to, try to speak up without continental support. But, you know, the Zimbabweans who were left to the tender mercies of ZANU-PF, for instance, would probably, you know, take issue. The Tibetans who, you know, hope that a visa might be forthcoming for the Dalai Lama, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The Ukrainians who can't figure out why South Africa can't actually call that a war. And, you know, reckons this must all be resolved, you know, without specific reference to Russian ordnance being off their soil, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, what South Africa can do is pledge solidarity with Venezuela. It can, you know, have a rip-roaring shindig around the Palestinian question. And the big irony there is that South Africa has nothing to offer and as good as no influence. And I, you know, when I say nothing to offer, you know, in the Middle East, I mean, I will say this both to Israel's defenders and those of the Palestinians. South Africa does not have experience in territorial claims or in ethno-religious nationalisms. You know, the transition to democracy in this country has nothing to offer there. But you know, it allows a certain ideological posturing, and that seems to be the limit of what goes for national interest in the country.
That's very much the case, and of course, we've seen the very bizarre stuff around. I remember Libya when the ANC supported Muammar Gaddafi for years and years and years, and then voted to get rid of him at the UN, and then sort of went back to bemoaning it and saying that they were tricked into doing it anyway. Foreign policy has not been exactly particularly clear.
You know, look, let me just say one thing for clarity. One thing that I think South Africa did, particularly in the 90s and early 2000s, which was very, very valuable, was the peace building and peacekeeping. But even that is falling through the cracks, because the army has been underfunded.
Right.
It's aging.
And that's why Rwanda is taking a very active role in Mozambique when South Africa's in the backseat.
You know, what precisely were South Africa's soldiers doing in the Central African Republic, for instance? But, you know, look, I mean, I do remember the, negotiations on board, I think it was the Otaniqua off the coast of what was then Zaire. That was very, very valuable. You know, for Africa to actually get takeoff, it needs stability. And I think that was something that was realized. Whether South Africa these days has the credibility to do that, is questionable. And whether it has the capacity, I think, no, it doesn't. Not anymore. Those glory days are behind us.
Definitely. Sorry, before I get your final thoughts, I just want to say, if you can't remember that we were in the Central African Republic in 2013, there was a bit of a shindig there, and I've actually posted a link to the Wikipedia article on the battle about it. A very bizarre period in South African foreign policy. Sorry, your final thoughts on all of this?
No, I think what one is seeing is probably what one sees in every sphere of political life now, and that is that the ANC only has ideology to work with. It doesn't matter what sphere of government it is, and I think that's what's left. And it's not as if it's really profound or admirable. It just is the only thing that hasn't changed in their lives, and I think that's why we see it being manifest in our foreign affairs, whereas our interests would be very helpful, rather.
You know, I think what Sarah says, we're stuck in this political groundhog day. We saw it at the ANC's policy conference. You know, and there's a big tragedy here. There are left-wing parties that have actually that evolved. And I remember reading there was something published about a decade ago about Latin America. So the countries that are actually moving are those that come from the old Marxist tradition, who kind of realize that, you know, they've got to like make some sort of agreement with business. And, you know, we go in from there and we focus on welfare. And then, you know, places like Uruguay did that. And that was kind of that was good. Venezuela came from the populist tradition, where it was all, there's an enemy under every bush. And, you know, today, well, we see a toilet with a lid ripped off.
Right. That's a good phrase. All right. So staying with foreign affairs, but not so much our own. Let us move on to our next story. And this is the big one that's made all sorts of international news. And that is the visit of the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, who is, I believe, third in line to the presidency if the president and vice president should be incapacitated. That is one Nancy Pelosi, who against pretty much the wishes of quite a lot of people, definitely the People's Republic of China, which said that her visit there, the first of a U.S. Speaker of the House since 1997, when Newt Gingrich from the Republicans went there, that her visiting would be playing with fire, and those who play with fire get burned. There was also a little bit of condemnation even from the Biden administration, who initially said something along the lines of, well, the military doesn't think it's really a great idea if she goes and visits because it's going to put Taiwan under threat or something like that. And there was an enormous amount of build-up to Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan, which is, of course, for those who don't remember the details, is claimed by China as an integral part of China, but of course is de facto essentially an independent country that calls itself the Republic of China. The flight by Nancy Pelosi into Taiwan was watched by, I think, 700,000 people on a website tracking live flights. And in fact, the website couldn't accommodate more people, so they had to restrict access because there were so many people watching it. And there was a lot of people hysterically throwing around claims that this was going to be the beginning of World War III on Twitter. Of course, that didn't happen. However, when Nancy Pelosi did land, she was greeted by sort of cheering crowds. And she said that the U.S. would never abandon Taiwan, that she was pledging solidarity, and she hailed the country's democracy. In response, China has initiated a number of military exercises and live fire drills all around Taiwan, which have, in some cases, violated Taiwan's nautical space. The Chinese government put out this map saying where they were going to do the live fire exercises and basically saying, stay away from these ships because you might get hit by mistake. And some of those zones that they identified crossed within the 12 nautical sea mile, which is line from the Taiwanese coast, which is basically considered their sort of inland territorial waters. So it's quite a serious violation of Taiwan's sovereignty. Pelosi said, our delegation came to Taiwan to make unequivocally clear that we will not abandon Taiwan. She also met with former Tiananmen Square activist, a Hong Kong bookseller who had been detained by China, and a Taiwanese activist who was recently released by China. There was a lot of people on Chinese social media who were very upset about this visit. And from the Reuters story, one of the quotes was, this old she-devil, she actually dares to come, which is...
I can just imagine how that plays out in Chinese, because they have very distinct words for devil. So it's probably nice. Yes.
In response to the drill, the Taiwanese said these so-called drill areas are falling within the busiest international channels in the Indo-Pacific region. We can see China's ambition to make the Taiwan Strait non-international waters, as well as making the entire area west of the first island chain in the Western Pacific its sphere of influence. In response, China's foreign ministry said it didn't really see what a big deal this was, and it hadn't interrupted the freedom of navigation of ships at all. So there. Terence, what do you make of all this?
Well, look, as perceptive viewers of the show will know, I'm very pro-Taiwan. Partly it's personal, partly it's political. I have family in Taiwan. And I spent a number of years there. But normatively, Taiwan is a democracy. It is the first democracy in the history of Chinese civilization, which is an old and venerable one. And it poses that in itself poses a particular threat to the ideological hegemony of the Communist Party of China, because central to their messaging is that democracy is not part of the Chinese character or worldview. Or, as one Chinese diplomat said at a conference that I attended in Berlin some years ago, we believe in democracy and human rights, but with a Chinese understanding, which apparently means you don't get to vote the Communist Party out.
And if you're a Uyghur from Xinjiang, you also maybe missing some of those rights.
Yeah, or, you know, some sort of civil libertarian big mouth netizen in Shanghai, you could also find your life rudely interrupted. This was something that I think the Communist Party of China was very concerned about, the demonstration effect, especially as some Chinese people were visiting Taiwan. And you're seeing actually these people are culturally similar, although very distinct now after a couple of generations. They're more prosperous and, you know, they seem to be getting on okay.
It's worth pointing out that, you know, a lot of people talk about China's incredible economic growth, and it has been pretty incredible, but on a per person basis, Taiwan has even been more successful, and it is wealthier than China is today.
Yeah. And look, you know, I think that Ms. Pelosi is, of course, a divisive figure. I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, I would say that she hasn't had a particularly good track record as Speaker of the House. She's not been very successful at passing legislation.
No, but, you know, 10 out of 10 for this, a guy from the Wall Street Journal, actually, which is not a particularly paid, particularly well disposed to her, said she has over her whole political career actually been very, very firm and consistent on this. And I maintain that
I may speculate that perhaps part of the reason why there has been some bipartisan consensus between Republicans and Democrats on the hostility towards China has perhaps been because Nancy Pelosi has at least kept the Democrats on side on that issue.
Yeah, look, you know, I also think that there is a kind of realization of both a hard security issue issue there. And also an ideological one. You know, America can be flaky on foreign policy, you know, who its friends are. But let's say there's sort of two hard cores. The one are the Europeans and the Canadians. Let's say the West. And then there's the West and the East, if you like, the South Koreans, the Japanese. And Taiwan falls into that almost by default. And that's why, Japan has become very, very, concerned about the situation there. And I think, you know, China's saber rattling over the last couple of years, not just with Taiwan, but with Japan, with Vietnam, with the Philippines. That's upset a lot of countries who see their own security in very stark regional terms. Then COVID happened, and I think China did enormous damage to its reputation of itself as a reliable, responsible partner. Now, something else that they tried to do with Taiwan was to restrict access to vaccines. Now, they did the same sort of thing in previous pandemics. But this time it didn't work. And you had flights from America and from Japan accompanied by fairly senior, like legislative figures, you know, bringing donations. And these are largely symbolic, but it was saying that, you know, we are your friends. And I think that the significance of all this is that under an American government that is in American terms so left wing as the Biden administration has become, and Pelosi being very much kind of seen as a left leaning or progressive Democrat, at this point to make the statement, it's very significant about the direction of geopolitics.
Definitely. Sorry, your thoughts on this whole issue?
I can't help wondering whether the Biden government hadn't wished it had redirected the drone that killed Osama bin Laden's deputy in Afghanistan and redirected towards Taiwan and Nancy Pelosi herself. I think what may probably stop this from developing more than sort of saber rattling, is the fact that she may be the Speaker of the House. But it is the Democratic Party, and it is, she is old. And I mean, there is an element to that sense of how, I mean, with all due respect, and I mean, not one to talk, but you know, when you hit, you've hit your 80s, you desperately try and look like you're not 80, but you can't. And you've gone from sort of left of center to left of God knows where, just to accommodate some really bolshy young women. I think that the Chinese would probably have a certain amount of disregard for the significance of it in terms of what America might ultimately do or not do. That's really speculation on my part, but it certainly keeps us awake a bit in that region.
Yeah, I wonder if that's the case because, you know, in a sense, the Chinese kind of created this issue. You know, if they had initially said she must remember that, you know, Taiwan is part of China or something and then just left it at that. But they blew it up into this crisis that's now sort of developed by raising the stakes and, you know, having these fiery.
But I think it's in the nature of the Chinese style of politics that moment of challenge has to be uber challenged in return. Even if fortunately no one's harmed as a result. And I think it's just it's the Chinese way of responding to an American way of doing things. So I'm really just sort of giving some rationale to the possibility that it's a lot of heat, but not really intended to be that much light.
But I think that the idea of face or reputation is very, very big in Asian culture, and the Chinese had to say something. They had to do something. As far as any real action, no. Look, I will give the Communist Party of China and the Chinese state this: that unlike our homegrown variants, they can behave sensibly. The Chinese military now does not have the sea lift capacity to mount an invasion. I don't see that being a feasibility for the next sort of 5 years.
And the logistics required to do a naval crossing would be probably quite evident, and everyone would know months in advance.
Yeah, look, you know, I think if you cycle back about 20 years, the Chinese leadership at that point might well have been edging to a kind of wait this thing out. You know, we'll become so wealthy that eventually they'll come crawling to us. But Xi Jinping is a very different creature. And I think there's what the works in this country like called toxic masculinity. I think that's very much, you know, a kind of driving force in Chinese politics now.
Definitely. And you know, there's an interesting theory I've seen bandied about, which is that China is not at the beginning of its ascension to global hegemony, but it's actually close to its peak due to some problems, like for example, its aging population. I think somewhere around 2050, at current trends, the US will actually have more people of military age than China, because this is the effect of the one-child policy. And so you sort of you have this very dangerous geopolitical situation where China is wanting to assert itself, but also worrying perhaps that if it doesn't do it quickly enough, it might miss its opportunity. But at the same time, it also doesn't want to do it before it's strong enough to do so. So a lot of room for miscalculation here.
Absolutely.
If you think the war in Ukraine had negative consequences for the global economy, wait until a war in the Taiwan Strait, and then we're going to see something crazy.
Absolutely.
Because that is one of the big trade zones of the world. Anyway, all that doom and gloom aside, we're pretty close to time here, so we don't have time to cover our third topic. I just want to say thanks everyone for listening. There won't be a show tomorrow, just to remind everyone of that. We will all be attending a funeral, but apart from that, I would urge you to support the Institute of Race Relations. You can do that by SMSing your name to 32823. That's on the banner behind me if you're watching on YouTube. like the video, subscribe to our channel, leave us good reviews of the podcast apps, all that stuff. And with that, we'll see you next week for the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.